So a little bit of background first. So prayer and illness. Studies show that people who are confronted with disease use prayer and other religious practices more frequently. The interesting thing about prayer is that it's also not specific to any one religious tradition. It can be used even by people who don't have any religious tradition at all. When we decided to do this review, we decided specifically not to focus on the effects of prayer, because that's where research has mainly focused until now. There was a review done by Halliwell, for example, in 2008, that looked at the effects of prayer on health. But we decided we want to go deeper, and we want to look at what do patients pray, and why do they pray, and even how do they pray. And as Masters and Spielman said, the research in this field is still quite limited. Before I go further, I'd like to just make a quick distinction between prayer and meditation. John Damascene defined prayer as the raising up of one's mind to God. In our modern society, meditation is often understood as a mental exercise, and it's not necessarily directed toward a higher being. For this review, we define prayer as the conscious act of opening oneself to a higher being. So in this sense, meditation can be a prayer if it is consciously directed at a higher being. So again, the aim of this particular review was, what do patients pray for? Why do they pray? Or what expectations do they have from their prayer? And we decided to also see, how do patients pray? And maybe you ask, why is this interesting? Why is it interesting to know what patients pray for? Well, I think it can be interesting because what if you have a patient who's praying for, they're trying to make a decision on what treatment plan to follow. And you might have a patient that prays a lot about about what medications they should take. And if you're aware of that, maybe you can help to guide patients, direct them and help them to sometimes distinguish between what is medically indicated and what maybe can be decided more concretely through prayer. Just as an example. So to conduct the review, we chose the three main medical databases, PubMed, Medline, and PsycINFO, and pretty basic terms, prayer or rosary, and cancer or chronic disease, illness, pain, or sickness. I left rosary up here, but after we did the search, we realized that it wasn't really relevant. But for the sake of transparency, I've just left it up here. So we initially identified 1,548 studies, many of those being duplicates. So after duplicates were removed, there were 146 studies remaining. We then screened the abstracts of all of the studies and came up with 33 studies that we found potentially eligible. And after a full text review, 15 studies remained. Most of the studies were excluded because patients weren't the main subjects of the study, or because intercessory prayer was the main focus. There were many studies in which prayer was only briefly mentioned in regards to complementary and alternative medicine. And a again, there were many studies that focused more on the effects of prayer rather than the content. I'm not going to list all of the studies here. They are in the presentation at the end. But just to give a quick overview, the earliest study that we found was from 1999. The total number of participants of all studies was 1,330, with a range between 10 and 360. The majority of studies were qualitative, which makes sense considering our question that we wanted to know the patient's perspective. Most studies consisted of cancer patients, but we also found studies of chronic illness and heart disease. And the participants in these studies were mainly older, over 50 years, mostly Caucasian, followed by African American. There were more females than males included in the studies that we found. And the large finding is that most of them were studies of Christian prayer or of patients from a Christian background. So after we gathered all the data, we tried to synthesize the results into different categories. We found initially 12 categories that you see on the right, and these we then grouped into four main categories: disease-centered prayer, God-centered prayer, others-centered prayer, and assurance-centered prayer. And I'd like to just give quick examples of each category. So for disease-centered prayer, we have improvement in health or state of mind, disease management, positive contributions. And as you saw on the last slide, this was also the category with the most results. So all 15 studies found patients that prayed specifically for their disease and specifically for improvement in either their physical health, but also state of mind health. Yeah. And an interesting improvement is pretty clear, I think, but interesting is that, as you see in the quotation, this was just a young boy, and he says, I go to sleep and then it doesn't happen. So he, even though he's praying for improvement, maybe he's not necessarily expecting to be healed. And then disease management, that has to do with making treatment decisions. Trying to maybe get up the courage to take medications that you don't want to take. And positive contributions is a way of trying to see the disease in a new light based on, through prayer. Then we have God-centered prayer. Of course, the relationship with God is an aspect of all of these categories, but here we found that prayer was really focused on the relationship with the divine. You see the category relationship of asking God for guidance, kind of like you would with a good friend. You would maybe ask a good friend, what should I do in this situation? So that's why we call this one relationship. Worship and adoration. Reflection being more of an active form in contrast to God's presence, which is more receptive, trying to just perceive God's presence. Prayers for others, interesting here. You don't only see prayers for family members, but also for healthcare professionals. And finally, assurance-centered prayer includes elements such as protection, strength and hope, trust and gratitude. Maybe you ask, why is gratitude assurance? Well, I think when you think of all of the positive things that you have in your life that reassures you, okay, things are going to be okay. And now, you may have noticed until now, I've listed more positive elements of prayer. And that was, those first four categories were the four categories that we found in our first search of the literature. And then we went back and we were trying to find more unpleasant elements. And we found that there are actually quite few, there's relatively little mention of unpleasant elements of prayer in the literature that we found. You see here that all of the quotations are from Taylor, and his study is the only one which really intensively investigated what he called spiritual conflicts associated with prayer. And for me, I think it's interesting because when I get sick, I often ask myself, why me? Oh, this is horrible, right? So you would think that actually elements such as complaint and fear would be more present. Just briefly still, we looked at how patients pray. You see, structure, there was no consensus. Some patients said that they find it important to follow certain rituals and use memorized prayers. Others said it's a conversation with God. There's no particular formula. There are different techniques that patients use. Time and place was also different. Some patients said you can do it anytime, anywhere. Others said they need a quiet place, a church. They do it at particular times before taking their medicine, before going into an operation. And only a few studies mentioned the involvement of others, but you did have a bit of mention of prayer perhaps being stronger, the effect of prayer being stronger in a group. And in one study with Catholic women, the women mentioned praying with saints, for example, patron saints of cancer. So to wrap things up, what can we conclude? We can conclude that even in the face of disease, prayer remains multifaceted. So prayer is not actually focused only on the disease or only on the patient's needs. I think that's an interesting point because I think, in fact, prayer for others, for example, could be quite meaningful. If you think of a patient who has maybe lost the ability to participate in daily activities, they're bedridden, then prayer may be, prayer for others, may be for them a way to still have meaning in their life. But that aspect wasn't touched on so strongly. And there were other blind spots. For example, that little attention was given to unpleasant elements of prayer. It's too bad because I think even these unpleasant elements of prayer can be windows of opportunity. And then there was also quite a bias in backgrounds. So there was a bias toward Christian backgrounds, there was a bias toward older populations, and to patients with cancer. So I think these are areas that we can continue to dive into deeper and to hopefully expand the research. Thank you. It varied. from population to population. As said, there was one study that, for example, had only women, Catholic women, and for them, it's a very clear picture of God in the Christian sense of the Trinity. There were, however, patients who prayed, but to a higher power. It was, at least in my memory, not clearly defined, but just defined that there are people who maybe don't belong to a particular tradition, but still choose to pray.
Another big task is you came across patients who had people from their church or community who were interceding for them. And yes, what would have been the impact on their, the way they dealt with the illness?
We actually specifically kind of cut out those studies where the patients were being prayed for. So I can't say a whole lot to that, but I think what I can say is that the patients who prayed for others experienced that as something very powerful, to be able to pray for others. So I think that it probably works both ways. I think also knowing that somebody is praying for you. There have been studies that have tried to prove the effects of long-distance intercessory prayer, and I think, to be honest, that it's a little bit far-fetched. I think it's more about knowing that there's somebody there to support you.
Professor Harold Comey has got a study, a randomized controlled trial, where it was proven that individuals who know that somebody is praying for them, is interceding for them, their recovery was much better than the others who didn't know that somebody was praying for them.
That I definitely agree with, that just the knowledge that you have somebody praying for you can be very powerful. What I was critical of is trying to measure a health improvement. I think that's difficult. I think.
So as you can see, here is Hajar Inn in Malta. Hajar Inn goes back to Stone Age, when people realized that the sun is huge, the sun appears to be a higher power, and so they, during the Stone Age, they felt that there is some form of higher power, and therefore they built this Hajar Inn. Hajar is stone, Hajar in Arabic, stone, Inn, a door. So Inn also is Arabic. It is still there. It's a Hajar Inn. Well, Malta is very small, so if you decide to go around, it is a very interesting place where to go to. So let's try to define prayer. So there is theistic prayer, where we can say that God is there in it. People believe that there is God, and therefore they build relationship with God. So various religions here differ in how they refer to God. For example, I was preparing the manual for the prayer book for this evening, and I learned a lot. For example, there are some religions that they don't even say the word Allah, God, or Yahweh. They don't even say it, because because God is so huge for them that they won't be able to. Okay, so a personal relationship with God, where we also refer to various religions here. For example, the Christianity builds a personal relationship with God, and they may ask God, praying God, to help them to change their mind, you know, regarding recovery and so on. Whilst, for example, the Islamic persons, they tend to pray, but they surrender themselves. It's the will of God. It is even more facilitated by the religion. Let me do the will of God. So then there is the monotheistic Eastern religions, as we have been saying here previously, that it is a higher power and harmony with the sacred, with the ultimate reality. So as you could see here, there is types of religions, and as you could see that even, for example, this evening you could see I've asked some form of religions and who are participants here, and their religious orientation won't allow them to participate in an interreligious prayer. So these are different prayers, but we are to tolerate them, and we are to try to respect them. Okay? Religious orientation: Christians may communicate with God on personal basis through Jesus Christ and all saints. So saints, in Malta, for example, they are very special because of each village has a patron saint, and every year this village would have a village festival in honor of that saint. Jewish and Islamic religions communicate directly with God in prayers also. So here we realize the influencing factors, the way people pray. It could be a prayer which could be read, but the heart and mind might not be there. But people might not pray, but they are in prayers. So inner mode and social context of individuals makes a lot of difference. Impact of myocardial infarction. Myocardial infarction is a life-threatening illness with biopsychosocial and spiritual implications. So myocardial infarction, the heart attack, we can realize that individuals have a life-threatening prospect here. That means we can identify that individuals who had a heart attack might die of heart attack. So the experience that I explored in these patients, they said that I felt, I encountered death in this myocardial infarction. So this is the factor of people who are experiencing myocardial infarction. They know of somebody, for example, that they had passed away because of their heart attack, or because of being afraid of another heart attack, which might mean loss of their life. And so they were really afraid on that point of chest pain, severe chest pain. Patients whose meaning of life is questioned and their life is re-evaluated. It's like a film in a split of a second. They evaluate their life, and they could identify what they have done wrong, mostly wrong, and what they have not done right. Then recovery time from myocardial infarction to return to normal life is one of uncertainty and emotional turmoil, both for the patient and the relatives. So please, let's remember also that the impact also is on the family. This study was done on Maltese patients, and in Malta, Maltese family is still, you know, is still caring, you know, and there is the family-centered care. patients with pericardial infarction face both an immediate fear of having another heart attack, and also now that I had a heart attack, now I am down for a chronic heart disease, a lifelong heart disease, impaired. So this is what the patient's experiences are according to the literature. So what is the connection between prayer and illness? There has been, literature shows that there has been positive relationship between prayer and health. And prayer as a healing power is still controversial in research. As Professor Koning revealed yesterday, there are negative impacts and there are positive impacts of prayer and spirituality. And healing experiences are often related to God and holistic impact, not just physical recovery. So here we can say that individuals experience inner healing, not just physical healing. It appears that their priorities in life are identified, and priorities in life therefore are given more attention later. Next, the methodology. This was part of the larger longitudinal study across the 5 years. I've done 5 years, but I'm presenting only the findings on the most acute phase. Semi-structured face-to-face interviews were carried out, and those were between the transfer to the medical ward and also on the return home. And the main questions were, to whom did you return for help when you felt the severe chest pain? What kind of prayers did you say and why? So theoretical framework, this is interesting, as Lazarus and Folkman here identifies that individuals, the way how they perceive stress, like myocardial infarction, it could be not only negative harm or loss, threat as negative, but also as a challenge. As a challenge. So this is the theory of Lazarus and Folkman, which is very, very interesting. So when we explore stress, mind you that stress can be interpreted by individuals as a challenge, so as a positive outcome. Then I use the theory of Rudolf Otto, where we can see here that there is the mysterious perspective in it. I've just published a paper on suffering, which is from mystery to the mystery, from the mystery of my suffering. How is it by me, for example? How can I understand God? How can I understand higher power? From mystery of suffering to the mystery, to God, to the higher power, who is also a mystery. Emotion-focused problems, so in an attempt of coping, there could be emotion-focused, one of which is prayer, and problem-focused. So the Rudolf Otto theory is, there is the numerous experience which when individuals realize that on the heart attack, they realize that they lost their control over their life, and so they feel their nothingness. Ken mahna shay. This is an expression in Maltese, which they express, ken mahna shay. So now I can understand my nothingness. In that perspective, in that theory, while we feel that I am nothing, there is that eagerness to try to reach a higher power. And that higher power for Catholics, so because this theory was explored by Rudolf Otto on monotheistic religions, Christians, Islam, and Jews. So here we can have an idea that the outcome of this perspective turning to God for and even research is showing that in patient illness, if a patient prayed, or if a patient was affiliated with a religion or believed at one point in time in their life, they tend to turn to that empowerment, to that source of empowerment. Use of prayer. So in that acute phase, before admission to hospital, I wonder whether you have experienced severe chest pain. So, severe chest pain, they equate it that I'm dying. So, it's either a point of turning to God for help, or I'm losing my family, I'm losing my dearest ones. So the first priority in that most acute phase was either they prayed to God or did not pray. And it's interesting that male patients, because we had male patients, because at that time I had 70 patients, 46 males and 24 females, see how many of them, even male, and male, according to research, male tend to be less religious. Findings. So I will go through them very quickly. 85% of females pray to God and saints, because they were all Roman Catholics, and 53% of males, they did pray. But we can see that there is a small percentage of even females that did not pray. So possible reason for not praying: did not understand meaning of that chest pain, expected pain to subside, busy trying to communicate with family members for help, and preoccupied with unfinished business and family commitments. We are not used to praying before myocardial infarction. So these are reasons for not praying. Then awareness, getting them to know why that severe chest pain is happening, and especially when they realize that they could feel it, that they are dying. So individuals, when they were, for example, when they were in the accident and emergency, there were some trying to say, to tell me how hectic life it was during the accident and emergency. And so they told me, the doctor is coming, isotropic pressure is coming, so many are coming, taking blood and so on. But at that time, I needed a priest. So here is the quick evaluation of their life. I needed a priest to confess so that I will, you know, try to be peaceful with myself and also with God and my interrelationships. Perceived loss, I found it because there were a number of younger ones who said, I've got children and I need, you know, somebody, I need to live, I want to live to continue to take care of them. Turn to God for help. So, threat of loss. So, that threat of loss, that nothingness, you know, and that severe pain, they could acknowledge that it is a pain which is equal to possible death. People panicked, and Jesus, please take care of me. So it's a prayer, it's a little prayer, but they turn to God for help. Fear of abandonment from God. So we could see here that individuals were dealing with experiences of, have you forgotten me? You know, that feeling alone, especially when that heart attack and that severe chest pain occurred when they were alone. 2 days of prayer. So we had fear of death, appraising, defining that severity of death, and aloneness. Findings. So intercessory. Yes, we stop here. Don't worry. Intercessory prayer for self and others. So they asked God for help, and also not only for help, but asked for others. Intercessory. They prayed not only for themselves, but also for their family, who are going to remain behind, so especially when they were children. Thanksgiving to God and requesting forgiveness from God and alignment with the will of God. So I can go. Okay. Intercessory prayers for others. I'll put all this PowerPoint, you know, on the website. Thanksgiving to God, asking forgiveness from God, and alignment with the will of God. Let the will of God be done on me. And this is, you know, the feeling of when they come to terms with their illness, with their sorting, even their unfinished business. They tend to be ready to leave, but they still work hard. This is on the acute phase, you know, the acute phase during the first 3 months of their recovery. So we have here, my soul longs to find refuge in you, O Lord. I shall find peace in you alone, St. Augustine. Reflection. So the reflection that people told me, you need to turn God when you are healthy and not when you are under the severity of chest pain. So recommendations, don't think. So recommendations, I hope that we try to even educate our healthcare professionals to allow patients and also to facilitate patients to pray in hospital. Don't think of the things you didn't get after praying. Think of the countless blessings God gave you without asking. Back to Malta. Okay.
From cancer. But the thing was that the more she prayed, it seems that the cancer got worse and worse. So I remember I went to visit her, and she literally spilled over the anger she had for God. And after that visit, I went to visit her again and found her more peaceful. My question is this: would you consider my visit, when she spent over her anger, as prayer or not prayer?
So let's realize the research, the current research which is going on now. The healing presence. At times, when people see you, they see a religious reminder in you. So our presence, we need to feel that, yes, I want to help that person, and that comes by silence. What is prayer? Prayer also means that we need to identify our nothingness and our feeling of the need of somebody higher. So our presence as caregivers could be facilitation of prayer, of realizing at least our nothingness. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
We changed a little bit the title. Yeah. So the benefit in
Thank you for coming. And I loved your presentation. So the two presentations were wonderful. But I loved yours especially because it fits 2 hours. It's interesting how your findings are similar to ours and you see now.
So,
it's interesting to see that some authors have the same idea about prayer, and they think prayer is the very soul and the essence of religion. The French sociologist, very well known, Marcel Mauss, and the psychologist of religion, William James, and the German theologian Heiner, they say the same. Religion is the very soul and the essence of religion. Is there any relationship between prayer and health? Because we are saying that there is a relationship. And in general, we take it for granted. But it's an important question. Professor Kevin Ladd and spoke in an article asking if there is any relationship between prayer and health. And what about prayer in a clinical setting? It's easy to perceive. It's not working here in my hand. Okay. Now it's better. Yeah. It's easy to perceive the relationship between prayer and health when we bear in mind the research on religious coping. Especially because prayer is the most frequently used religious coping method. But from the theological perspective, there is no guaranteed relationship between prayer and outcomes. The majority of the religious tradition states that prayer will be listened to the deity, not that deity will respond to prayers in a specific way. And Ladd and Spielkin criticize research which views faith as a treatment strategy, or even worse, in the perspective of well-being, which blames the old person for his or her own spiritual religious life. They stress that promoting prayer for its potential health benefits disregards the essential impetus behind prayer. And they present some studies they analyze. In the cardiovascular domain, for example, they stipulate to include additional factors as lifestyle, jobs. In this area, the research leaves more questions than answers, and its shortcomings are abundantly evident. Regarding to cancer, it's obvious that you have to widen the research from prayer to the religious lifestyle. In relation to unnecessary prayer, no study supported its effectiveness, and the results were disappointing. Prayer is a process of connecting to self, others, and the sacred. As a way of connecting, Robert said, a kind of relationship, the quality of conditions of the connection matters greatly. Why we developed this analysis, because there are not many studies analyzing prayer from the perspective of prayers. And perspective of the subject. In addition, we will discuss the implications of this term for the clinical practice. larger sample. It was collected in 2009, 2011, and 104 subjects were interviewed, 73 women and 31 men, average age 51 years old. Americans were the majority, some Latin Americans, some Africans, and they come from several regions in the United States. The interviews were recorded. 10 communities of faith, 3 Roman Catholic, 5 Protestants, and 2 Pentecostals. Socioeconomic stats, you can see there. Educational status, many of them have a postgraduate degree, and some of them bachelor's degree. Just 1% have some high school. We used the content analysis as a method of research to analyze these 104 videos. And the question was, if you feel comfortable doing so, please describe in as much detail as you can do one of the most powerful experiences you have had with prayer. When you do this question, they have to analyze their prayer life and to choose to select the most powerful. And it was interesting because we can analyze their prayer life from this perspective. We found 4 categories. We found prayer as a spiritual religious coping method. 62%, almost 63%. Prayer as a discipline to keep their spirituality alive, 15.3%. Prayer as a mutual empowerment, and prayer as a turning point in the existential process. Don't you think it's so similar? Yeah. So, prayer as a religious coping method, we found 2 types of prayer, petitionary and tears. The subjects reported that prayer was their main religious coping strategy they have resorted to in situations such as divorce, grieving, illness, relationship problems, problems at work, unemployment, difficulties to forgive, sort of anxieties, abuse, miscarriage, and material needs. Prayer as religious coping methods petitionary and tears are the types of inward and upward oriented prayer that comprise this category. Through these types of connectivity, they ask both for material things and emotional support as well. Therefore, they gain comfort and care since these types of prayer are emotion-focused coping strategies. And they do not necessarily expect good physical health when they ask for that. They feel much stronger to cope with difficult situations. For example, almost 10 years ago, it's an interviewed person, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And she said that she was very desperate, and she cried a lot, she yelled, and at the end of her interview, she said that sometime she thought, everything will be alright. And you know, it wasn't a Pollyanna, she says. It wasn't a Pollyanna kind of thing. I heard the words, I felt the presence. That was for me pretty powerful. Prayer as a religious coping method is not only must not only to ask for good health, and beyond physical needs, they seek for mental and emotional support. Sometimes, maybe a negative religious coping. For example, a woman said, "Recently I asked God for something, for some help. And well, a year ago, probably for some help and the direction I was going. And then I had a major life change and I think I've been upset ever since. So I'm trying to figure it out, but I think it's connected and I'm trying to seek what it is. It was just the beginning, I think, the change that occurred. I think it's all related to my request." So sometimes it's not like a person would like to have an answer from God. And as you said in a few minutes ago, this experience of becoming worse and worse, sometimes it happens. And I think it's a very important moment for pastoral care and counseling to help this person to find another way to deal with this. Now, prayer is a discipline to keep the spirituality alive. And two types of prayers are used here, sacramental and rest. In sacramental, they say that it's a daily life way to be connected with God, or they go to a ritual to feel connected with God. Prayer is a technique of mutual empowerment. The intercessory prayer was the most important prayer experience for only 8, almost 9% of the interviewers. It's interesting that in the United States spent lots of money with this kind of prayer, but just for only 8% of the interviews, this was the most important type of prayer. And Brunner, a theologian, he emphasized that the aspect of cooperation with God is the most important in this kind of prayer. And prayer is a turning point in the existential process. We found two types of prayer we didn't find in other studies. Calling, and we call this kind of connection or connectivity as epiphaneia. It is a moment when the life has changed forever, can be changed forever. And calling is a type of despair and conversion and the movement of the spirit. The interesting thing about this kind of prayer is that unlike the other modalities of connectivity, inward, outward, and upward, that originate from the subject, these types of prayer come from an exogenous dimension, as if they originated from outside toward the subject in prayer. They don't feel as it comes from them, but it comes from outside. Now, we talk about three implications to the clinical practice and pastoral care and counseling. The first one is the necessity to understand health beyond a biomedical perspective. I think it's the most important thing, because researchers have been stressed this biomedical model, and prayer is not used only to have physical health. And the implication is that power cannot be seen as a complementary alternative medicine. Prayer cannot be prescribed. If you understand prayer as a medicine, you could prescribe. But prayer is a spiritual tool used for spiritual purpose. And another implication is that the subject's attachment style and the quality of prayer connectivity is important. Yeah. And I think the attachment style is very similar. The attachment style people could you help me, please? The attachment people use in their lives, it is the same when they pray. It's the same style. Is it understandable? And I think when you understand the attachment style of the subject, you can better understand some types of prayer. And it's important, especially for pastoral care and counseling, and they can help people in this specific thing. I think it's almost okay.
I'm sorry.
I don't have the slides. I think you can switch it off. First of all, I'd like to thank Professor Donia Ballacchino for inviting me to contribute into the symposium and to slot me, actually, in the symposium. The practices of medicine and belief in the supernatural have always been closely associated. And historically, medicine has only relatively recently become an evidence-based applied science, despite clear and strict separation of today's medical practice from organized religion. Several studies have shown that belief in the metaphysical and the practice of faith are in many contexts important to individuals. This is especially so when persons are undergoing life-changing events, as we've seen in these past papers, or indeed when worried about their health. I will first consider faith. Faith is an act of will to believe without requiring proof. It therefore relates to matters that cannot be proved objectively by evidence. It's not an easy concept to define, and in practice it's impossible to quantify faith. Two essentially similar definitions of faith come from different sources, dissociated both in provenance and in time. The letter to the Hebrews addresses faith, both believers and non-believers, and describes faith as the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. 2 millennia later, Oxford zoologist Richard Dawkins states that faith requires no justification and brooks no argument. I should now like to consider briefly medicine, which is firmer ground for me, I must admit. It's only relatively recently that medicine has become a form of applied science. For thousands of years, medicine was practiced as an esoteric art, a jealously guarded and much studied tradition. The relationship between faith and medicine is to be explored. One needs to reflect about the changes in the practice of medicine over time. It is not possible to determine when the practice of medicine started, as evidence for healing antedates both texts and historic events. But almost certainly, the first physicians were also priests. And as ill health was often seen as retribution from a deity or an angry spirit, the priest physician acted as an intermediary between the real world and the supernatural. The first identifiable physician in history is Imhotep, who lived about 4,500 years ago, the third dynasty of ancient Egypt. Although he was also high priest to the sun god Ra, he wrote the first known medical text that did not contain allusions to magic or the casting of spells. Fast forward in time, by about 2,000 years, Hippocrates practiced medicine on the island of Kos around 400 BC. And careful observation, correct behavior, meticulous documentation were the hallmarks of what he called an art. For the first time, medical practice was considered separate from religion. Yet the original Hippocratic Oath was itself a declaration of faith and opened with an invocation to many deities. I swear by Apollo, the physician, and Aesculapius and Hygieia and Panacea. A modified and modernized version of the Hippocratic Oath taken by medical graduate of this university ends with the word of hope and faith. May God help me keep this promise. The elements of modern scientific method were probably formulated around 1225 by Robert Grosseteste, who was a bishop of Lincoln. He was both a philosopher and a theologian. About 40 years later, Roger Bacon, a Franciscan friar who was master at Oxford, described formulation of hypothesis and a scientific method. Yet medicine, a profession steeped in arcane tradition, lagged behind in adopting scientific method. As an example, one only needs to cite the study of anatomy. Any form of medical training has to be based on a good knowledge of the human structure and function. In actual fact, this knowledge came relatively recently to doctors, as there were legal and religious impediments to the acquisition of such knowledge. Roman law forbade dissection and autopsies, and therefore no scientific basis existed for the anatomical studies and drawings of Galen, who lived around the year 200. This obscured medical thought for hundreds of years, and even as late as the 16th century, the excellent anatomical studies by Vesalius were mocked, as they were not in conformity with Galen's studies, which were based on pigs and performed 1,300 years earlier. Evidence-based medicine has been a major landmark in the evolution of medicine as a scientific discipline. And increasingly, medical practice now follows complex guidelines, rigid protocols, and administrative regulations. Indeed, in this year, to practice medicine otherwise is tantamount to opening oneself to adverse comment at best and litigation and legal sanction at worst. Rapid advances in medical science, and in the way that medicine is now practiced, poses a crucial paradox. There is no doubt that the practice of medicine is becoming increasingly dehumanized. Yet medical treatment is becoming increasingly personalized. The growing dehumanization of medical care is euphemistically called clinical detachment and non-personal involvement. It is of great concern that patients are perceived exclusively in scientific terms, and therefore not treated humanely as in patients, but in terms of damaged organs or deviations from the abnormal in laboratory tests. As a consequence of super-specialization is a so-called team approach. This may result in dilution of responsibility, relative physician anonymity, and reduction in meaningful and consistent communication with patient and family. The fear of medical legal litigation often leads to the practice of defensive medicine. It is already reshaping the practice of medicine, and it is difficult to determine whether these trends are the cause or the effect of decreasing personal involvement between patient and doctor. I should like now to proceed to discuss the relationships between faith and medicine in the general terms of convergence, divergence, and hurdles to understanding. Faith, science, and medicine converge in their perspective of searching for absolute truth. The paths taken are sometimes different, and the methods employed are non-interchangeable and vary according to the route taken. Yet in the words of Rabindranath Tagore, facts are many, but truth is one. Medicine and faith diverge, as they have different worldviews. The domain of faith is a spiritual one, in contrast to the material one of science and medicine. The thinking process in the domains of faith and medical science is different. The approach to faith is obviously very personal, and is often flexible and adaptive. This is in contrast to the impersonal and categorical clinical reasoning underpinned by uncompromising science and medicine. The method for search in the domain of faith and in the practice of medicine is often at variance. An individual's journey in the realms of faith is a personal and subjective one, in sharp contrast to the objectivity of measurement, precise degrees of scale, and the quest for mathematical certainty in the sphere of medicine. There are hurdles between medicine and faith. They are essentially the same hurdles that limit understanding between different disciplines and intellectual endeavors. Super-specialization is one particular hurdle. In any particular field, super-specialization leads to isolation, and the quest for depth without consideration of breadth possibly leads to misunderstanding through lack of consideration of the holistic dimensions of the broader aspects. Intellectual arrogance, or the view that one's domain or field of expertise is inherently superior to one another, is another potential hurdle between discussion, understanding, and dialogue between different domains and beliefs. Fear, or the unwillingness to venture outside one's intellectual comfort zone, is a further hurdle to dialogue between the domains of medicine and of faith. This is confounded further by unawareness at best and ignorance at worst. There is a conflict view. There are many views between faith and medicine or medical science. The conflict view suggests that medicine and science, faith and medicine, are mutually exclusive. They make opposing statements about the same matter. And I'd like to quote two particular proponents of this view. Francis Crick of DNA fame suggests that not only do beliefs of most popular religion contradict each other, but by scientific standards they are based on evidence so flimsy that only an act of blind faith can make them acceptable. On the other hand, somebody says, science and religion are reconcilable in irreconcilable conflict. There's no way in which you can be both properly scientifically minded and a true religious believer. The conflict view is a very categorical one. There's an independence view, then, that suggests that there is no conflict between science and faith if they are considered as entities and that are completely independent. This view suggests that medicine and faith are two completely separate but legitimate practices without any overlap, in that they differ significantly in their methods, their realms, and the function of life. Then there's a dialogue view. In this particular model, it suggests that there is consonance between medicine and faith. Both fundamentally seek the truth, and therefore dialogue between the two must be one of respect and understanding. From the general concepts, I'd like to proceed briefly to address specific and practical interfaces between faith and medicine. It may be difficult to comprehend how individuals who are the subject of serious, unexplainable illness and harm to themselves, their family, and their community remain strong in their faith, and actually thank the deity. The faith of persons in the face of personal physical mishap is often a real mystery and a source of wonderment to many in the medical profession, as well as to many non-medical scientists. The crisis of faith in the face of adversity was first addressed in the book of Job. I quote here, "He desired to reason with God, and And he called his friends who discussed with him the dispute between reason and faith, forgers of lies and physicians of no value. The issue of faith, harm and evil was addressed by Moses Maimonides about 800 years ago in his magisterial work, Guide of the Perplexed, the sage who urged that you must accept truth from wherever source it comes, must have struggled very hard, both with his unshakable faith and his medical beliefs, given that he was concurrently the leading Jewish theologian and the most distinguished physician of his time. At a different level, it is very puzzling how a community that has been ravaged by cold-blooded physical brutality and systematic inhumanity remains true to its faith. A recent example of this is the resilience of the Jewish faith, not only in the face of methodical genocide, but also in the aftermath of the Holocaust itself. To change tack slightly, the interface between faith and medicine, and when considering serious illness, there are circumstances where religious faith is chosen in preference to medical advice, thereby potentially putting health and life itself at risk. Indeed, certain faiths preclude certain or all medical interventions. Perhaps the most common and widespread experience in this regard is related to patients who are Jehovah's Witnesses. According to this non-mainstream Christian faith, they believe that blood transfusions are prohibited by biblical edict even when life is endangered. The followers of Christ Church and Christian Science Church, mainly based in the US, are strict in their practice of faith healing and refuse medical advice. Christian scientists believe that healing is only possible through complete submission of God and maintain that prayer, anointing and laying of hands are the only acceptable treatment. At times there are tensions between the taking of medical decisions and one's own faith. At a personal level, I don't mean me, it may be difficult to find the right balance between medicine and faith. And some may actually opt to even reflect on this thorny task. A physician's own moral values and the practice or lack of faith often color the way that certain medical situations are approached and actually dealt with. At a different level, there may also be personal tensions between one's faith and what is permissible and what is not permitted by the law of the land. To discuss this further, one would have to enter the domains of medical ethics and medical jurisprudence. I should like now to discuss faith in intercessional prayer for the restoration of health, really. In the medical context, prayers are offered as an act of faith for continued health or for restoration of good health. In this regard, a prayer becomes a supreme act of faith based on the belief that a deity would intercede at a personal level. The supplicant is often unconsciously, in reality, beseeching for an alteration in the normal physiological process or hoping for an arrest in the pathological process. It's not easy to study the petitionary prayer with regard to medical matters. The normal rules of cause and effect do not apply as they would in other interventions in medicine. There is also a quandary when considering the investigation of prayer in relation to medicine. On one hand, a strictly scientific yardstick could be used by applying that gold standard of medical science, the randomized controlled trial, in order to test the efficiency of various types of intervention. This has in fact been applied in septicemia, cardiovascular disease, and in advanced AIDS. One of the most comprehensive, rigorous studies was undertaken by a team led by Harvard cardiologist Benson. The results of this large study raised more questions than provided answers. In these studies, however, it's very difficult to establish a clear scientific and consistent causal relationship beyond association. A natural consequence of any discussion of faith, prayer and medicine is the consideration of faith in miracles, nearing the end. These may be described as events that are unexplained by the known laws of nature, which occur through divine intervention. For some believers, certain perspectives are simpler than others. And there was a lovely discussion which I lifted from a recent book, The Life of Pi. In The Life of Pi, if you can remember, there were three men from different faiths discussing their own religions. And the Imam declared, "We Muslims seek to the essential miracle of existence. Birds flying, rain falling, crops growing, these are miracles enough for us." As in the case of prayer, the domains of spirituality and clinical medicine are concerned are entirely different, and one cannot attempt to discuss medical interventions and miraculous interventions through reasoning process and methods that are common to both. For my final attack now, I'd like to discuss personal issues of faith and its compatibility with scientific evidence. Doctors very often have to deal with the most basic and raw issues of life and death. Despite an avowed clinical detachment, and unless they have emotional and moral anesthesia, doctors have to come to terms with themselves about what to believe, about what not to believe, and when to suspend disbelief. In both theoretical and practical terms, a medical practitioner often has to adopt a mental switch that allows shuttling between to and fro, between belief without proof, that is faith, on one hand, and the measurable reality, that is scientific evidence, on the other hand. This dilemma is a most personal matter for most doctors, and it's an extremely personal issue to discuss with most doctors. It's a dilemma that is conditioned by background, training, experience, and past exposure to particular events. There is no doubt that a human brain can not only handle the shuttling between completely different mindsets, sets, intellectual concepts and contents, but actually feels comfortable in each domain. To take an example, in the realm of science, a physicist readily accepts and works with such disparate concepts and systems as classical Newtonian physics on one hand and quantum mechanics on the other. Each domain has its own rules, and a physicist has no problem shuttling from one to the other. In conclusion, some doctors come to terms with this dichotomy of faith and scientific evidence, while others do not. But they go on to develop their own coping mechanisms with regard to their faith. Cardinal Carlo Maria Martini, who died a couple of years ago, addressed this issue and urged that to understand one's faith, one has to constantly question it. He suggested that there is within us two people, a believer and an unbeliever, each trying to convince the other. To this duality, which is quite old, like the yin and yang of classical Chinese medicine and philosophy, one may add the wish or the will to believe. This very dilemma is so poignantly yet elegantly put in the Gospel of Mark, through the words of a long-suffering father whose son suffering from epileptic fits. I do believe. Help my unbelief. Thank you very much. Actually, this gets up.
One question? Yes, do you have a belief in the power of faith? Can it be, can medicine say, for instance, that the actual belief, my belief in the God, can trigger the chemical reactions that can make me more resilient against illnesses, for instance?
Thank you. Thank you for that point. Perhaps we should do it. There have been some studies, and it has been suggested
It triggers some immune responses. It's extremely difficult to prove cause and effect. This is what I'm trying to say. I mean, the studies between related prayer and effect show a beneficial effect, a betterment in feeling, or an increase in quality of life, if you wish. But to actually prove in scientific terms, with a ruler, but that's a scientist, how much, how often, precisely, so the cause and effect, the causal relationship, I think beyond association, you can't do that.
ATCL,
it's an association. It's a, but to say that it's, this causes this, it's... It could. This be postulated. That we don't really understand yet. You're absolutely right. I mean, it'd be postulated that this could be an immunological change or immunological transformation. Probably we'll find out one day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.